To my parents, who somehow had a crazy faith in their son's quixotic dream of becoming a writer. Prelude. The Pilot House. From the time he was a small boy in Hannibal, Missouri, the Mississippi River had signified freedom for Samuel Langhorne Clemens, later known as Mark Twain. A place where he could toss aside worldly cares, indulge in high spirits, and find sanctuary from society's restraints. For a sheltered, small-town youth, the boisterous life aboard the steamboats plying the river, swarming with raffish characters, offered a gateway to a wider world. Pilots stood forth as undisputed royalty of this floating kingdom, and it was the pride of Twain's early years that right before the Civil War, he had secured a license in just 2 years. However painstaking it was for a cub navigator to memorize the infinite details of a mutable river with its shifting snags, shoals, and banks, Twain had prized this demanding period of his life. Later, he admitted that, "I loved the profession far better than any I have followed since," the reason being quite simple. A pilot, in those days, was the only unfettered and entirely independent human being that lived in the earth. In contrast, even kings and diplomats, editors and clergymen, felt muzzled by public opinion. In truth, every man and woman and child has a master, and worries and frets in servitude. But in the day I write of, the Mississippi pilot had none. That search for untrammeled truth and freedom would form a defining quest of Mark Twain's life. For a man who immortalized Hannibal and the majestic river flowing past it, Twain had returned surprisingly few times to these youthful scenes, as if fearful that new impressions might intrude on cherished memories. In 1875, as he was about to turn 40, he had published in the Atlantic Monthly a 7-part series titled Old Times on the Mississippi, which chronicled his days as an eager young pilot. Now, in April 1882, he rounded up his publisher, James R. Osgood, and a young Hartford stenographer, Roswell H. Phelps, and set out for a tour of the Mississippi that would allow him to elaborate those earlier articles into a full-length volume, Life on the Mississippi, that would fuse travel reportage with the earlier memoir. He had long fantasized about, but also long postponed, this momentous return to the river. "But when I come to write the Mississippi book," he promised his wife, Livy, "then look out. I will spend 2 months on the river and take notes, and I bet you I will make a standard work." Twain mapped out an ambitious 6-week odyssey, heading first down the river from St. Louis to New Orleans, then retracing his steps as far north as St. Paul, Minnesota, stopping en route at Hannibal. The three men sped west by the Pennsylvania Railroad in a joggling train, the very mode of transportation that already threatened the demise of the freewheeling steamboat culture Twain had treasured. By journeying from east to west, he reversed the dominant trajectory of his life, enabling him to appraise his Midwestern roots with fresh eyes. "All the railroad station loafers west of Pittsburgh carry both hands in their pockets," he observed. "Further east, one hand is sometimes out of doors." Now accustomed to the genteel affluence of Hartford, Connecticut, where he had resided for a decade, he had grown painfully aware of the provinciality of his boyhood haunts. "The grace and picturesqueness of female dress seem to disappear as one travels west away from New York." To secure candid glimpses of his old Mississippi world, Twain traveled under the incognito of Mr. Samuel, but he underestimated his own renown. From St. Louis, he informed Livy that he "got to meeting too many people who knew me,"